Well, I'm very honored to be here. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to take part in celebration for Kathleen. Kathleen's work has been very inspiring to me, but on top of that, Kathleen has been, his personality has been very attractive, and has always been a distinct pleasure to be close to her. So just one wish, many more occasions for many years to come. Now my lecture, I will try to explain the difficulties that one faces when dealing with systems of hyperbolic conservation laws with source terms. And I apologize for using the overhead here. I still belong to the transparency generation somehow, but I see that the Fields Institute even is willing to accept chalk, so I don't feel as bad for that. I think I will start from scratch for the benefit of those of you who are not familiar with the theory. My apologies to the experts who are here. So here I have written the general system of hyperbolic conservation laws in one spatial dimension. U, the unknown, takes values in Rn here, and the system is strictly hyperbolic in the sense that the Jacobian of F has real distinct eigenvalues and therefore linearly independent eigenvectors. And I'm looking at the Cauchy problem, and definitive result, perhaps the only really definitive theorem for the Cauchy problem, is this famous existence theorem that says that if the total variation of initial data is sufficiently small, there exists a unique admissible solution of class BV. And this theorem has a long history. It was first proved by the random choice method by Gleim in the 1960s. We now have two additional methods of proof, the front tracking method by Bressan and his students, and the vanishing viscosity method by Bianchini and Bressan. The restriction that the total variation of initial data is sufficiently small is essential. The theorem at this level of generality is false without this assumption. There are examples of systems for which the solution with large initial data, solutions blow up in finite time. It's a challenging open problem to classify systems for which this is not the case. And there is a hope that the systems of interest, systems arising in physics, will belong to the special category for which the Cauchy problem is well posed for large initial data, but no progress has been made in that direction in recent years. Now, this theorem is proved. The proof relies on a careful study of the result of interaction of elementary waves. Elementary waves for such systems are shocks and rarefaction waves. And since you are dealing with a system of n equations, you have a family of n distinct waves, one for each characteristic family. So you can think of wave fans composed of such waves, and the strength of a wave fan is measured by the sum of the strengths of the waves that compose the fan. Now, if two wave fans are allowed to interact, they produce a very complicated set of waves, but it is possible to associate with it just one wave fan that describes more or less the result of the interaction of these wave fans. And it turns out that the strength of the outgoing wave fan is bounded by the sum of the strengths of the two incoming wave fans plus a certain term that's of quadratic order in the strength of the waves. Now, without this quadratic term, establishing existence of solution would have been very simple. You would have been able to find a nice bound on the total variation of solutions. The quadratic term is small so long as the strength of the waves is small, and this is where the strength of the waves the size of the strength of the waves come into play. But it's not negligible. And one of the major contributions of GLIM was to teach us how to estimate these interactions here. So by using this estimate, one can show that the total variation of the solution at time t is bounded by the total variation of the initial data, and this is the basic estimate that eventually gives you existence of solution. Now I want to consider the case where my system has a source term, or perhaps even the system is non-homogeneous, so the flux F and the source term G also depend explicitly on X and T. In both cases, I'm assuming that the zero is a trivial solution, so G of zero has to be zero, and this condition should be satisfied to make sure that this is the case. Of course, typically, our general experience from partial differential equations is that these are the boring problems. Once one knows how to solve the homogeneous problem, adding lower order terms increases the complexity of the analysis, but does not require any new ideas. Here, however, the situation is more delicate for the following reasons. Suppose that you try to apply the method that worked before, namely consider two wave fans that interact and produce a new wave fan epsilon, and try to estimate how the strength of the outgoing wave fan relates to the strength of the incoming wave fans. So in the place of the estimate that I had before, you find this estimate here. The new term is this RH. R is some constant, typically positive. H is roughly the time that it takes for the interaction to occur here. So by using this estimate in the place of the earlier one, one obtains for the total variation a bound of this type. You have this exponential in form of the total variation. Now, this estimate is good enough so long as t is small, let's say bounded. So you can use again the standard methods for proving local existence of solution. But as t increases, the size of the total variation of the solution may increase and exit the range on which our methods work. Because you remember, our methods work only for as long as the total variation remains small. So the problem of getting existence of solutions in that case, in general, is open. And I think it will stay open, of course, for as long as we don't know how to solve the Cauchy problem for the homogeneous case with large initial data. However, in the applications, the source terms are typically special. For instance, they're dissipated. So the question is whether one can use dissipated initial data in order to compensate for this difficulty here. Now, of course, dissipation means many different things. And, of course, the simplest question here is, what would be the assumptions on G of U that would render that exponent R here negative? In that case, if R is negative, the source term not only does not hurt, but in fact it helps. Right. So this would be the case of what I would call strong dissipation. And many years ago, we looked at this problem with Ling Xiao, and we found out that the right assumption on G is that the matrix H, which is defined through this equation here, R here is the matrix whose columns are the eigenvectors of the Jacobian matrix of F. So you build this matrix H, and you require that it is diagonally dominant. Once this is diagonally dominant, then indeed it turns out that the R is negative. Talking about waves, when this condition is satisfied, any wave interaction is dissipative. What comes out from the wave interaction, what comes out is less than what came in, to put it in a rough way. This is not an unexpected or mysterious condition. For instance, if you look at the linear system, linearized system or linear system, this is exactly the condition that tells you that the solution operator is contractive in L1. So contractive in L1, of course, naturally gives you a bound in the total variation of solutions in the nonlinear case. So you have this condition, and you start applying it to problems of interest, problems, special problems in which you do have some kind of dissipative source term. And here are two examples. This is the simplest one, the first one. It's a system of, let's say, elasticity with frictional damping, perhaps a gas flowing through a porous medium or something like that. Here's another example, which has been studied a lot in connection with relaxation. So in that case, also you expect dissipation whenever the so-called subcharacteristic condition is satisfied. And indeed, for these systems here, we do have existence in two extreme cases, by two extreme in two extreme situations. First of all, in the case of smooth solutions, because it turns out that because of the dissipative terms, when the initial data are very smooth and very small, you have globally defined smooth solutions. And with the opposite extreme of very weak solutions, let's say in L infinity, by means of the method of compensated compactness. How about DV solutions? Can we apply the previous criterion of dissipativeness to get the existence of DV solutions? And the answer is, unfortunately, no. In other words, if you check, you find out that the strong dissipativeness condition that I said before does not apply in this case. Okay. Now, what does it mean that these terms here are dissipative? If you look at wave interactions, you find out that they are not locally dissipative. There are some wave interactions in which, indeed, you are getting decay of the waves, but there are others in which these source terms amplify the outgoing waves. Okay. On the other hand, we all know that such terms are dissipative. And what is the manifestation of dissipativeness in this case? Well, entropy estimates. Let me remind you, for such a system, you say that eta of u is an entropy with associated entropy flux q. If this condition is satisfied, this implies that good solutions of the system, even weak solutions, satisfy this inequality in the sensor distributions. Now, g will be dissipative relative to that entropy if this condition is satisfied, which of course implies that the total entropy is not increasing. Right? This is the meaning of dissipativeness in these exams that I gave you before. So this is a different kind of dissipation. It's in a gross sense. A functional of the solution is decreasing, even though locally at each point, the wave interaction may produce amplification of waves. So the question is whether you can use this kind of gross dissipation in order to compensate for the lack of local dissipation in the system. So let me show you a simple trick that allows you to do that. So let me consider the situation in which I do have a system of conservation laws with a source term. And I know that the solution is stable in L1. So I know that solution satisfy an estimate of this type a priori. Such an estimate, of course, I can only get from an entropy type estimate. Then you do the following thing. You try to change variables. You write U as the sum of V and W, where W is again a function of the solution. Capital N here is some constant matrix that I will choose later. Of course, if we don't know the solution, we don't know V, we don't know W, but at least we know something about W. We know that the total variation of W is a priori bounded because the total variation of W is like the L1 norm of U, which satisfies this estimate here. So somehow we pretend that we know W even though we don't. Then you write the equation as an equation in terms of V, and of course now it becomes an inhomogeneous system where F and G depend on X and T explicitly. And let me show you how explicitly it depends on X and T. Not that it will make any sense at this point. There's not enough time to absorb really the details of these formulas, but in any case, these are the red equations, tells you how F hat and G hat are constructed from F and G. Okay, then you ask the question, is it possible that perhaps even though in the original system G did not satisfy the strong dissipativeness condition, G hat in the new system does? So for that purpose, you have to compute that matrix H hat. Now, of course, depends not only depends now on X and T, for each X and T, and check whether it is diagonally dominant or not. So again, the calculation tells you that H hat is related to the old H through this equation here. So you see, the idea is, can I choose N, that matrix that determines the new variable W, in such a way so that H hat is better than the H that I had before. Right. So here I have stated this again. This is what I need. I want to get an H hat that is diagonally dominant. And H hat is related to the old H through this equation here, where Q is induced by the N that I have chosen. Now notice that for diagonal terms, H hat coincides with H. So there's nothing I can do with diagonal terms. However, with off diagonal terms, I have a lot of freedom here. I can make the proper assumption here and improve H hat. In fact, I can make H hat diagonally dominant just by choosing the N in a way that this thing is equal to zero. So this is more or less the idea behind this. So it seems like a very cheap trick, but it works. It works because it works in all the interesting examples in which you have dissipation. So here is the theorem. It says that I start with the Cauchy problem with my system with a source term. I assume strict hyperbolicity. I compute this matrix H. I only assume that the diagonal terms, the principal diagonal terms of H are positive, but I also assume that I have an L1 estimate for solutions. Now under these assumptions, if the L1 estimate of the initial data and the total variation of the initial data is sufficiently small, then I do have a global BV solution, and it satisfies an estimate of this type. R here is negative, so you see that the information induced by the total variation of the initial data is forgotten, and the only term that still affects the total variation of the solution for large T is the size of the total mass of the initial data here. And of course, the useful thing is that this assumption that I have here always works whenever you have dissipation. When you take any system with dissipation, this assumption is satisfied, even though the diagonal dominance condition is not. Of course, the price that one has to pay is the assumption of this estimate here that is not easy to deduce in most cases. So let me give you an example in which such estimates do arise. Here I have more or less a sketch of the proof of this theorem, but I think you understand what the idea is. The idea is that from U, you pass to V, and V satisfies a dissipative equation, so you can find a priori bounds on V, and also W, the other component of the solution here, has total variation controlled by the L1 norm of the initial data, and therefore by combining things together, you get the proof of the theorem.
It's not again what N is.
Yes. Right. Here it is. So, I changed the variable U in my original system. Write it as V plus W, where W is defined like so for that matrix N here. And of course, N has to be selected in such a way so that the resulting system in V is dissipative, strongly dissipative, even though in the original system G is not strictly dissipative. This is more or less the idea behind this. Okay, so now let's look at the issue of L1 stability. As I told you, the only source of possible a priori estimates of this type comes from entropy estimates. Of course, most systems are endowed with a convex entropy estimate, so you do have some kind of estimate, but it's usually of the L2 type. It's the L2 norm of the solution that is controlled by the L2 of the initial data. But here, in order to make application of that, you want L1 type estimates. So you can only work with systems that have many, many entropies, so you have the flexibility of constructing L1 type entropies, entropies that have L1 growth. And these are mostly systems of two conservation laws. So already, this approach is heavily restricted to systems that have a rich collection of entropies, mainly systems of two conservation laws. But in that framework, the method works quite broadly. So for instance, let's take this example of a system with a relaxation here under the subcharacteristic condition. So in order to find the L1 type estimate for solutions, I have to construct an entropy. This equation here tells me that eta is an entropy. This entropy has to be convex. This is the convexity condition of the entropy. This entropy has to be dissipative relative to this source term, which is expressed by this requirement, and that's where the subcharacteristic condition comes into play. The subcharacteristic condition tells me that indeed this condition is likely to hold for a convex entropy. And most importantly, this entropy should exhibit linear growth near the origin. So this is the difficult part. But in this case, you can do it, and let me explain how you can do it. You try to construct your entropy in terms of new variables called Riemann invariants, V and W, that are defined from V and U through these equations here. So now the entropy will be a function of V and W. This is standard in the theory of hyperbolic conservation laws. I apologize, of course, to most of you who know this stuff. Now, eta as a function of GW is an entropy if it satisfies this equation here. You see, this is a linear hyperbolic equation. Kappa is just a known function in terms of G and W. Now, for eta to be convex, not as a function of GW, but as a function of the original variables U and V, you need these conditions here. So this is, these are conditions that you need. And also, you need eta to have linear growth in terms of Z and W. So here is how you do it. It's very simple. This is your original system. You identify the equilibrium curve, the curve along which the source term vanishes, and you write it as a function of in the new variables W and Z, and you notice that the subcharacteristic condition, what I call the subcharacteristic condition, tells us exactly that this function G is monotone. So you have this red curve, this monotone curve, G of Z, and in the vicinity of the origin, you want to construct a solution of this system that has linear growth and satisfies the convexity condition. And it turns out that you can do it by solving a Cauchy problem with this type of initial data. This is the crucial term that dictates the linear growth of the entropy. This term here, for some new positive, has to be added in order to guarantee the convexity of the entropy on some vicinity of the origin. So if you study the system, you find out that indeed it meets all the requirements. So it allows you to get BV solutions for this system here. Okay, now let me consider a somewhat more ambitious example, since I still have it. Let me consider the case of this system here, which, as I said before, can be thought of as describing gas flow through a porous medium. This is joint work with Ron Quapan. What is the objective of studying this system here? Now, in classical physics, one neglects inertial effects, neglects the acceleration term V sub t, and finds out that V sub is related to U through this equation here, which is called Darcy's law. And then the first equation will tell you that U satisfies the so-called the porous media equation. So the objective of the theory is to see whether there is a relation between the more precise hyperbolic model and this simplified theory. Let me remind you that in the case of the porous media equation, one has self-similar solutions, and these solutions have this profile, a profile like that. They're very flat at minus infinity and plus infinity. They decay exponentially, and their derivatives decay exponentially at minus infinity and plus infinity. Like that, they connect, let's say, a state u minus with a state u plus. And the question is whether asymptotically, as t goes to infinity, the solutions of the original hyperbolic system decay to such a profile. Now, this is a problem that has been studied quite intensively, and here I have written just a list of people who have contributed to this problem. And if you look at this work, you see there are two types. Either they consider smooth solutions, which exist globally if initial data are smooth and small because of the presence of dissipation. Or they consider very weak solutions, which are infinity solutions, and go through the method of compensated compactness. So the idea here is whether a BV theory is also relevant in that case. So now to set the problem precisely, you start with this hyperbolic problem, you start with initial data that converts at plus and minus infinity, let's say to u plus u minus, and then you try to prove that as t goes to infinity, the solution converges to the profile that I had before, the profile with a similar solution that is given by these equations here. So you write U as the sum of U tilde and W and V tilde and Z, and you try to solve that W and Z go to zero in a certain sense as t goes to infinity, always staying within the Bézier framework. Right, so here is the theorem that comes out. This is the system that is satisfied by the perturbations W and Z, and you have the initial data. And then the theorem says that indeed there exists a global Bézier solution for that system and satisfies estimates of this type. You see here we have L2 estimates, L2 type estimates, L1 type estimates, and estimates in the total variation. The L2 type estimates are familiar in the theory. Many people have used L2 type estimates for that purpose. Again, they are based on using entropies, but standard entropies with quadratic growth somehow. So I'm not going to deal with them at all. The more interesting part of the work is the is establishing the L1 type estimates, because from the L1 type estimates and the approach that I described before, one can obtain then the total variation estimates and so on. So for this for this purpose, again, one has to use entropy flux pairs. But now look at the system. The system is more complicated. It's not homogeneous. U tilde here, I remind you, is known, but is a function of x and t. So now the entropy flux pairs will depend on this parameter here, U tilde, and this is the system that they have to satisfy in order to qualify to be entropy flux pairs, and this is the inequality that they satisfy once you can obtain such estimates with eta, of course, convex in W and Z. All right, so you have somehow to deal with this inequality. And to get the L1 estimate, you have to satisfy an entropy that satisfies a set of rather ugly conditions. Of course, it has to be convex in W and Z. It has to have linear growth. It has to satisfy dissipativeness conditions. So these assumptions are very natural. But in addition to that, it has to satisfy very somewhat asymmetric growth conditions with respect to various variables W and Z. So this is not an elegant set of conditions. What makes it elegant, if you wish, or nice, is the fact that, as it turns out, this is exactly the best that you can prove also. Right? So this is the least that you need, and this is exactly the best that you can do. So it's some kind of minimax type of theorem. And you can do it by, in a very simple way. So you want to solve this system here, and you just start with, just solve a Cauchy problem with these very simple initial conditions. You find out that the WZ plane is divided into four regions here by means of this function here, chi. And inside these two regions, you know the solution of the solution explicitly because you started this very simple initial data. Of course, the challenge is to look what happens in the other two regions and to estimate the growth of the solution eta and to show that it satisfies all these rather strange and ugly conditions that it has to satisfy. But it turns out that you can do it. That's the only justification that I have for presenting it somehow. That indeed, the conditions are not nice, but these are exactly the conditions that come out from this construction here. So you can use that method for establishing BV theory of the asymptotics of the sort of porous media equation as well. Okay. I think I'll stop here. Thank you.